Okay, let me start off with something that's current. It was mentioned at the conference, and you know, sometimes I feel that when someone, you know, someone asks me a question on the spot, sometimes you feel, you know, you don't respond well enough. And I would like to just take this opportunity to do that at this point. The question, it was asked me about capital punishment and the methods of killing of the Torah. Now, I just, you know, they asked me what the method was, and I basically explained the method. What exactly is meant by stoning? It doesn't mean you throw stones out of the at the person literally, but you throw them off a very high spot, and then you know, and the damage that's caused that way kills them. But I'm not interested right now in the method of killing, which is in the Torah, but the concept of killing, I think, is something which we have to understand, which I think is more important. It has very important philosophical implications, and especially in our society today. Now, we know the Torah is the Word of God, and it projects the most perfect system for man to live by. And the difficulty with Torah is that it goes by reason and not simply by emotions. I just saw the other night where Jeffrey Dahmer was the serial vicious killer was killed himself by an inmate, and they interviewed someone, I believe it was from the prison, and the person said, he was shaken, this is a terrible tragedy. Struck me as strange that this should be a tragedy, that a man who is a vicious killer has taken human life, tortured human beings, that this is a tragedy, this person's life was taken when he didn't deserve to live, the man should have been killed a long time ago. The problem was the tragedy didn't occur early enough. Had it occurred earlier, human life would have been saved, and human torture and suffering would have been spared. But that's the nature of this society, that the society goes by emotions, not by reason. But God's Torah goes by reason, and when you go with reason, so then you do that which is good and that which is just, and you have compassion in the right place. You see, that's the man-made religions always go by emotion, because the man-made religion is just a reaction against aggressive emotions, so then they go to the other side. But they never go to the proper side, which is the side of reasoning. And in the Torah itself, you find that this point, God thought it worthy enough to spend several verses on this point. And I draw your attention to Deuteronomy 19, okay, where in Deuteronomy 19, it tells you about the person, the beginning of 19, it tells you about the person who kills unwittingly. And for that person, we set up these cities where the person, and there were many of them, and where the person could run to, and he would be safe. Okay. Now, I'm not going into that halacha right now, the structure. It's a complex structure, halachic structure. And there's a very deep psychology behind this whole thing of the man living in the city and not being able to leave till the death of the high priest. There's a very deep psychology behind that. But I'm not going to go into that. I want to draw your attention to the verses that follow that, where that's 19:11. Where it says, and if there's a man that hates his friend, okay, and he lies in wait for him, and he gets up upon him, rises upon him, and he kills him, and he dies, and then if that person should run away to one of these cities, so then you should, the elders of the city, that means the Sanhedrin, the ones who are the wise men, they should take him from there, and they should place him at the hands of the one who is redeeming the blood, and he shall die. I'm not going to go into exactly how he's put to death. But what I want to cite is the next verse, that you shall not have any compassion upon him, and you shall remove the spilling of innocent blood in Israel, and it will be good for you. Okay, Torah emphasizes that. Then again, you have in Deuteronomy 19 a little bit further. Where it says the case where a person testifies falsely against another person, in an attempt to have that person killed through the judges. In other words, a false testimony against somebody in order to have the judges put that person to death. Then you, if it should be discovered, that's verse 18, if it should be discovered that this witness is a liar, is speaking falsely, then you should do unto him exactly as he intended to do to his brother. And you shall remove the evil from your midst. And then it says, those who remain shall listen and see, and they won't continue to do this terrible thing again in your midst. And then again the Torah emphasizes in verse 21, you shall not have any compassion. And it should be a life for a life, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, okay, etc. What is the Torah over here? It shows us that at times we are not permitted to have compassion, and on the contrary, having compassion in such a time is really evil, is an evil, is actually an evil, and God warns us against this. Now, it's interesting, I was listening to this show that they had, where they're televising a debate there's a debate that's being on Mayor Koch and several others, lawyers, on the concept of the death penalty. And there was, of course, the old argument is always brought out, well, what if we make a mistake? Okay, first of all, that argument is inaccurate anyways. When a person, there are people that killed the serial killers, there's no doubt about the fact that they are murderers, and they even admit it themselves. So there are many cases where there is no chance of error, zero, okay? And nevertheless, those who are against capital punishment are still against capital punishment in that case, where their argument collapses. But let's just assume we'll forget about that, the inconsistency. But let's take the argument in a particular case. So one lawyer stated, and it sounds like a very good argument, he says, since there's always a chance of error, he says, I would rather let one guilty person, five guilty people go free than kill one innocent person. Okay? Which sounds, on the surface, he's right, you know? After all, you'd rather let five guilty people go free than to kill one innocent person. So he says, therefore, we can't have any death penalty because we're going to make a mistake. We might make a mistake. See, now this, on the surface, sounds logical, but when you think into it, it is not logical. And that's what the Torah says. The Torah says that you must remove the spilling of innocent blood from your midst. That's what it says in Deuteronomy 19. Which means, what these people are very short-sighted. What they don't realize is if you let five guilty people go free, you are killing 20 innocent people. Because these guilty people are murderers. They're killers. So over here, you cannot be short-sighted. You cannot say, well, I can't take a chance on killing one innocent person. You are killing innocent people by allowing murderers free. So do not think, you have no choice in this matter. You are caught here in a situation where you must act. And you must act as justly as you possibly can. And if you refrain from acting, you are standing by while innocent people are being killed. That's what people don't understand. They always focus on their attention on the person that's on trial, and they do not see the ramifications. They feel many people identify with a criminal. That's a psychological thing. People identify with criminals. I'll give you an example. People go to a movie and they watch a gangster picture, and they feel sorry the gangster's caught at the end. This man is a ruthless killer, but everybody feels, oh, too bad. If only he would have escaped. He could have made it. So people have a psychological tendency to identify with the wrong people many times. And there are many people that identify with murderers and killers and criminals. And they think, well, that could be me up there. Now, that's a psychological quirk of human nature, but it's not something that should guide a rational person in his decision-making process. And that's precisely what the Torah is saying. So where a person has misguided pity, what he is doing actually is causing the deaths and the torture and torment of many, many innocent people. That's why the Torah says that the Torah prohibits a person many times from having compassion. Compassion can be a sin, okay? Yeah, for instance, in Deuteronomy, take a look at Deuteronomy 13. All right, Deuteronomy 13 speaks about the person who instigates, who talks, who instigates one into serving idols. 13:7. Okay. Yes, if thy brother, the son of thy mother, or thy son, or thy daughter, or the wife of thy bosom, or thy friend that is as thine own soul, and the rabbis say that means your father, entice thee secretly, saying, let us go and serve other gods, which thou hast not known, thou or thy fathers, of the gods of the peoples that are round about you, nigh unto thee or far off from thee, from the one end of the earth even unto the other end of the earth, thou shalt not consent unto him, nor hearken unto him, neither shall thine eye pity him, neither shalt thou spare. Well, the spare really is, actually should say, have compassion for him. Neither shalt thou conceal him, okay? But thou shalt surely kill him. Thy hand shall be first upon him to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. And thou shalt stone him with stones that he die, because he hath sought to draw thee away from the Lord thy God, who brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And all Israel shall hear and fear, and shall do no more any such wickedness as this, in your midst. Okay? So I think the message of the Torah is pretty clear. And anyone that believes that the Torah is the Word of God and cannot deny the fact that the Torah considers a person, a certain forms of human life, as not worthy of existence. And not only that, but the Torah recognizes that if you spare him, if you have compassion in such a case, what you are doing is you are not having compassion, because that is not rational compassion. That's emotional compassion. What the Torah demands of man is rational compassion.
Rabbi?
Rational compassion means taking into consideration the entire society. Okay, yes.
Yeah, the Lawrence Ledford asked the question, and the example that you're giving in Deuteronomy 13,
okay,
and if I understand it correctly, in with the false prophet, does it require two witnesses?
Yes, requires two witnesses.
Okay.
Can't do anything without two witnesses.
Okay, all right, that was the question. Thank you.
Yep. Okay. That's why, for instance, a Mother Teresa type is not considered in the eyes of Torah as a perfected person. Because in order to be perfected, you have to be able to do what is truly compassionate for innocent, good people. If a Mother Teresa cannot slit the throat of a Nazi killer, then she has no compassion. She has no compassion for people. Because that means this Nazi killer will destroy others, and she will be the cause. So that is a case of a person simply going, repressing one side of their nature and just assuming a certain attitude of compassion all the time. But that's not rational. That compassion really harms people and really destroys lives. So a person must be rationally compassionate, not emotionally compassionate. And if a person is only emotionally compassionate, then they are not. That is not true compassion. Okay, that's the ideal of the ideal of the Torah.
All right, Rabbi.
Yes.
Another. This is a major question in this area.
Okay.
Now we understand the Torah concept of avodah zarah, strange worship, idolatry.
Right.
Now, if we take this passage that you're dealing with here,
mm-hmm.
and we can see this is involved in a Torah society. Okay, how does that apply to us today, and how should we respond to the idolater, the one that would draw people away today? If we kill the Nazi that's killing 6 million Jews, what about these people that are leading billions of people to hell or to paganism or whichever term you want to put it? What should be our response to them?
Okay. There is no doubt, according to the Torah system, that they are equally deserving of death. Whether a person is a killer or whether a person kills people ideologically, which means that they teach them ideas which take them away from God and make their life worthless. There is no question about it. Of course, in our society, we are very limited because our society doesn't live by the seven laws of Noah. In our society, you could be an idolater and be a very good citizen. So our society is not one that implements the Torah way of thinking, for the simple reason that our society came to the realization that they cannot know which religion is the correct religion. So since you can't know which religion is the correct religion, they have to say, well, we'll give everybody religious freedom. That's the second best thing to do. And we are happy about that because had they chosen the wrong religion, then we would all be in trouble. So democracy basically is laissez-faire. They say, look, whatever you guys want to do, you do. We have nothing to do with it. But we who are committed to the Torah faith, we know what the correct religion is, and we certainly would say that such an individual is deserving of death. There is no question about it. Anyone who preaches idolatry, that's exactly what the Torah is talking about. As a matter of fact, and you see how beautifully the Torah words it. It says, it mentions those people that are very emotionally close to you, your brother, your sister, the wife of your bosom, and the person that's like your own life, and the rabbi said it means even your father, which is extremely, the person is perhaps the closest individual to a man, certainly, and to a daughter as well. And, you know, here the Torah is depicting the closest possible relationships, and the Torah is saying that you should not allow compassion to get in the way of executing justice. And this is something which we should practice. But in our society, we are very limited. We can't just, we can't go around killing people that are idolaters in this society. We're not living on the society of the Torah law. But certainly we should not assist such people. I mean, there is something that we should all be aware of, and that is that a person is not, for example, if people do not accept the seven laws of Noah, you know, very well, we know very well that they are not fit for life. They are not fit to live. Nevertheless, you see that when the people of Israel would go to war with one of the nations that are in their midst, they would first call out for peace. And what they would do is offer them the opportunity. They'd explain to them the seven laws and offer them the opportunity to keep the seven laws. If they rejected the seven laws, then they were deserving of death. But not until they actually rejected them. So you have to realize that there are many people who may be idolaters that are not deserving of death simply because they've never had the opportunity, they've never been informed of the seven laws and the concepts of the seven laws. But once a person is informed and he continues in his way, in his idolatrous practice, then they are deserving of death. There is no question about that. But again, we in our society are limited. We can't do that. But we certainly can, in any way possible, to assist such a person or to prevent such a person from harming someone in any way that we can, any way which is legal. But we can't break the law of the country. Simply because if we did that, then we would just what we would do is just bring destruction upon ourselves, and then we'd be destroying the whole system of Bnei Noach.
Rabbi.
Yeah.
What about the rabbis that we know that refuse to take a stand that you've just taken against Christianity, that for fear of an outbreak of anti-Semitism, fear of rejection, that they will not even make the statements that you just made? Now, how do we reconcile that to our philosophy?
By the way, I just wanted to mention to you something before you're going further, that Maimonides does say in the Mishnah, and it probably is translated, so I'm not letting out any big secrets. He does say in the Mishnah that they would, even in later times, if they knew that someone was an idolater and was one of those type of people, they would remove him quietly. But this Maimonides states. But But of course, you have to realize that you cannot do something which you have to be, as I said, a person. The Torah demands a person be rational. It means use wisdom and knowledge in everything they do, which means to say that you have to be able to assess the situation that you're in now. If someone would, if Bnei Noach, for instance, Bnei Noach can bring a sacrifice, okay? Now, if the Ben Noach would bring a sacrifice today, I think it would be a terrible thing to do, because that would basically, you're not obligated to do so, and that would basically destroy the entire movement. You'd be preventing people from listening to the ideas of Torah. So I would think that certain things, you know, you have to use your wisdom and your intelligence when you make decisions. Now, the rabbis that, I don't know, I'm not really familiar with you know, the philosophies and intricate detail of these rabbis. I've not really spoken to them at length, but, and I don't want to condemn anybody, but I would say this, that, you see, a lot depends on how you assess the situation. There are some people who have lived through horrible times, the Holocaust and even before, and to them, the fear of anti-Semitism is a fear of actually having Jews being slaughtered. That's what comes to their mind's eye. So in that case, there would be no obligation on a Jew to, you know, to speak out against Christianity and have people killed because of that, have Jewish people killed. I mean, he has no obligation to do that, and it wouldn't be right. I mean, you have to wait for the right time. Again, you have to use wisdom and knowledge. I personally disagree. I don't think that at this time, if in our society, I mean, thank God, I think that as I say, I always say, I'm very optimistic. I think that people always say, well, the old values are falling away. I say those old values were no good. They were basically idolatrous values, and it's a good thing they're falling away, because now that the idolatry is falling away, which is namely the church, which is in serious decline, now people are searching for something, and now they have an opportunity, especially with the development and growth of Bnei Noach, to hear true ideas. So this I look as a good thing, and I think that in our climate right now, I do not think that people come out. If they come out against Christianity, that we're in danger right here in this country of people, anti-Semitism, and the killing of Jews. I think that, and I think as the moment the danger is removed, that we should try to move in the way of knowledge and truth, and advance the truth to everyone that we can. That's an obligation. I know a lot of Bnei Noach have asked me, they said, well, how come all these years, you know, the Jewish rabbis never taught us that the our teachings are false and these ideas are false? But the only thing is that you have to really study history to realize that Jews were not able to do that other than at the expense of their own lives, which would simply put an end to the Jewish nation. I mean, that would be very foolish. So you have to understand the historical background over here, and what the Jewish people lived through. And when that is clear, then you'll see why that was so. But a lot of people are entrenched in attitudes, and it takes people time, even though changes take place. It takes people time to adjust to those changes. I can't judge those people, because I, thank God, was born in this country, and I never lived through a Holocaust situation or a pogrom, you know, the type of situation. I've read about it, but there's a big difference between, you know, the Talmud says there's no comparison between hearing and seeing. And so I'm a person that had heard, but I never saw such a thing. So I look at things differently, and some of these people, due to their experiences, are rooted in the, you know, attitudes that would be more appropriate to the past. I don't blame them for what they say, because they're basing it on their on the ideas that the political ideas that they have, which happen to be false, but, you know, I mean, the Torah ideas are correct. They will all agree in terms of the Torah ideas. Political, they have a lot of arguments about political concepts. But in Torah ideas, all these rabbis would agree that wherever possible, and you don't endanger human life, you should speak out the truth and try to remove idolatry further. And that's really the whole function of Bnei Noach. Any further questions on that?
Well, I don't know, but again, I understand what you're saying, but it would appear to me that the Torah is very clear, and although we don't live in this environment that permits people to kill, and I'm not advocating going out and wholesale murder these guys, but I think the truth of Torah has to be presented, as it will be in the age of the Messiah when the Torah will reign supreme. And see, I never heard these things taught until we began to study with the rabbis, and yet I still see that many are reluctant to say anything in a negative sense against anyone. And we're not, I think you have to separate the people from the philosophy that you're not talking about a person, but that you're dealing with the philosophy. And when you do that, you are not emotional. You are being intellectual, because when it gets down to the personal level, then it becomes very emotional.
Mm-hmm.
But you must deal with it from a philosophical standpoint.
I couldn't agree more with you.
Okay. All right. So that.
Yep.
Wait a minute. Well, Sandra, you want to come and put this on tape? All right, Sandra was making a statement. She don't want to put it on tape. No. Why don't you come and tell us? Well, she said she might get it wrong. See, she's learning. She said she doesn't want to say it on tape because it might be wrong. I think it's clear, so we can go from there.
Okay. With regard to this, the rabbis have an interesting statement. They say, whoever has compassion and pity for a wicked person will eventually someday be wicked towards a person that deserves compassion. Okay? And they cite the case of Saul, King Saul. But they say King Saul had compassion on Agag, who was the king of Amalek. And so there was a man who was compassionate for a wicked individual. And later, he killed out the Nov, the city of the priests, who really were deserving of clemency and were really righteous people. So the Talmud says that those two incidents are cause and effect. They're causally related. Now, how are they causally related? One would think just the opposite, that if you have compassion for a wicked person, you're certainly going to have compassion for a good person. But no, the Talmud is just the opposite. If you have compassion for a wicked person, then one day you are going to be vicious and be wicked towards a good person. Why does the Talmud say that? But the answer is very simple. Because if you have compassion for a wicked person, then it just shows you you're just operating by your emotions. You're not operating rationally. If you're operating rationally, you would have compassion for all the people that this wicked person is going to destroy. Now, once you're operating on an emotional plane, then it's just a matter of time till the emotions swing the other way, and until someone who is truly righteous gets your anger up, gets your emotions going, and then you'll kill that person because you're not operating on a rational plane. That's what the Talmud teaches us. And, of course, I mean, that is the Torah philosophy. Anyone that reads the Torah and the prophets will see immediately that is the Torah philosophy. As a matter of fact, when Agag was brought before Samuel, so he made a strange statement, if you remember. He said, the bitterness of death has turned away. And that sounds very strange, because then the next moment Samuel killed him. And many interpretations given to that statement. It's a strange statement in the prophets. But I think the interpretation is very straight and clear. See, when they brought him before Samuel, he thought he was going to be spared, because he thought this is the religious man. The religious man, the prophet. The prophet's not going to kill me. He's the religious man is always the nice person. And he said, okay, my life was spared. The bitterness of death is turned away. It means he's going to be spared. But Samuel surprised him by killing him. Because Samuel was not a, let me continue here. There were certain things that I wanted to that we mentioned at the I think about the conference, and I felt that perhaps we didn't have an opportunity to elaborate enough on them. And we spoke about the amazing concept with Sarah and Abraham, how Sarah foresaw through prophecy that would Ishmael remain in the house of Abraham. When Abraham died, he would claim an heir. He would claim that he's the heir. And that would mean that he's the heir to the philosophy of Abraham, and that there would be an unbroken chain straight back to the God of Abraham. Okay? You would have two chains. You'd have the chain from Isaac going to Israel, and then you'd have the chain from Ishmael. Now, we mentioned there that, and that's why she chased him out. That's why she sent him out. As a matter of fact, one of my students asked me a good question. He said, why did Abraham send out Ishmael without anything, just a little bit of water and just the meager necessities? He was a rich man. Why didn't he give him money and other things? The answer is because he was a teenager at the time. We don't know exactly how old he was, but he was a teenager. And Abraham had to make it obvious that he is chasing him out. In other words, that he is disowning him because of this danger of him claiming the claiming that he is the heir to the philosophy of Abraham. Now, it's very interesting because he's a great personality. Ishmael was, as I said, Ishmael was not a bad person. Ishmael is recognized by the rabbinical scholars, the Torah scholars who read the Bible very, very carefully, as a person, as a matter of fact, who was a righteous person, because the Torah says that when they buried Abraham, so it says Isaac and Ishmael buried Abraham, which means that Ishmael allowed Isaac to go first, even though he was younger, because he recognized that he is the one that is the true heir to the ideology of Abraham. So he was a righteous person. And he was a good person. See, things in the Torah are not black and white. People are always looking for black and white. But the Torah is very careful. Each personality is analyzed in its own way. Now, we mentioned that the amazing thing is that what Sarah's prediction really took place some 2,300 years later, when Ishmael, the Arab nation, laid claim exactly precisely to the philosophy of Abraham, the God of Abraham. And they accepted the Torah straight through Abraham till Ishmael. And there they say, well, now the Jews corrupted the rest of the Torah. So that's precisely what they did. But the only thing is that she forestalled this event by 2,300 years, and now there is no unbroken chain. That's important to have. It's important to have an unbroken chain. See, we don't realize, a lot of times we ourselves get caught up in this, and we want to change the world. You know, we want large numbers of people. That's what we're concerned about. But that really, in a sense, is false. The Torah is concerned about every single human being. That's why the famous quote from the Talmud, if you save one person, you save the whole world. Because the world was created for this person. Many people enjoy the world, but the world was could be created for each of them, if they're virtuous people. One Abraham, okay, was enough for God in his era. And from this one Abraham, some 400 years later, there were 3 million people. So we don't realize a lot of times what we do. We want immediate results. But we don't realize that if we can save one individual, this can amount to, in generations and generations and centuries, this can amount to thousands and thousands and even millions of people. So God knows the future. We have to be concerned about every individual. And the Torah is very concerned about every individual. Now, here was Sarah, who was the great prophetess. As a matter of fact, the rabbis say, when God said to Abraham, listen to her voice, it means her voice of prophecy, a prophetic voice, that she was a greater prophet than Abraham. The rabbis say that. So the point is that this prophecy has great import, and you could see that it's true. You can see that it's true because authenticity is the first step towards a person discovering Torah. And I think David will corroborate this, and that is that when David started looking into religious matters, he started to take a look at one. Just a second. Who was Jesus? Where did he come from? And he started to. He noticed an unbroken chain from the Jewish people straight back to Abraham. Now God did not wish that there should be two unbroken chains, because then people who were searching for the truth would not be able to immediately, upon investigation, recognize which is the true which is the true way of life. So there you see that even though Abraham did an act which had seemed to lack compassion, because he had to chase out, and it bothered him very much. It says, the Torah says, that it was very bad in the eyes of Abraham. Let me get the verse exactly. And this thing was very, very bad in the eyes of Abraham about his son. That's in 21:11. Okay, but then God said to Abraham, says, "Do not feel bad about this youth and his maidservant. Whatever Sarah says to you, listen to her voice." And that, then look at the end of the verse, how beautifully it fits in. It says, "Because in Isaac there will be called for you seed." What does that mean? That means that the world will call the seed of Abraham the seed through Isaac. So here God told him what was the consolation that God was giving Abraham. After all, he felt bad. It was his son. He loved his son. And Ishmael was a good son, as I explained. He was a good son. He was an instinctual son. He wasn't like an Isaac, but he was a good boy. So God, what consolation can God give him? So God told him, no, because it's true, you have compassion right now for this Ishmael, but you have to realize that more important is to have compassion for people in generations coming that will be searching for the truth. And if there are two unbroken chains back to you, then these people are going to be misled. And hundreds and thousands of people are not going to be able to discover the truth. Now, while it is correct that the B'nai Noach movement is a small movement and really has hardly existed in the past, but you still must remember that every person, every virtuous person, is important in God's eyes. And throughout the ages, there were people that were able to find their way back to God's Torah through the fact that they recognize that there's only one unbroken chain, one way of life that goes straight back to Abraham. And that was precisely what took place in this Genesis 21, which is, again, the concept of true compassion overruling emotional compassion. And here was very powerful emotions, Abraham's own son. But he had to overcome that emotion, because the true compassion is for all those people in the future that are searching for the truth. They should be able to discover it. So here again we find this the same concept. That's why God said, don't feel bad. Your feeling bad is because of compassion. That compassion is not really as important as compassion for all those other people. Because in Isaac will be called for you a seed, and in no one else. And if Ishmael stays here, then he's going to be called your seed, and people are going to be misled. Okay, I think that's an important concept, because it is true. What the Torah is teaching us is the true idea that people do find their way to Torah through the mere fact that there's an authentic chain straight back to Abraham. This arouses curiosity. So once, just a moment, let's see, what is Christianity? Where did it get to have its basis from? Where were these people from? And you start investigating the people, and then you start seeing the way of life, you start seeing Torah, you see something totally different than you've been taught. And this is the way for a person to reach Torah and to reach God. Okay, I just thought that was something worthwhile elaborating on. Again, in this very same, the words of the Torah are so brilliant in terms of psychology and philosophy, and I always like to point out here and there we come across something. Like, for instance, you'll notice how the Torah, in its cryptic way, very cryptic way, it says, And Sarah saw, that's in verse 9, 21:9, and Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, who gave birth to Abraham, mitzachek, means playing. So here the Torah doesn't say what he did, but what is playing? You see, what is the definition of play? What does play mean when we play? Here, if you're looking carefully in the Torah, you'll get a definition of what play is. See, play is instinctual gratification in a harmless way. Okay? That's what all play is, basically. Play is really two kids take little cap guns and they say, boom, you're dead. What does it mean? It means say it's aggression, but in a harmless way. See, the aim is inhibited. In other words, you inhibit the aim. You're not really killing the other person, but it's a joke. What is a joke? A joke is an instinctual gratification, but it's a joke because you're not really carrying the instinct all the way through. Okay? Now, the Torah doesn't say there's anything wrong with that. All right? There's nothing wrong with it. But a person who spends his life in the instinctual is not, in the Torah's eyes, on a very high level. That's precisely what the Torah is telling you. That this Ishmael, even though he controlled himself and he was a good boy, but the fact is, what was he involved in? Instinctual gratification. Yeah, he held himself back. But a person like that, he might be a good man. He might be a good person. And he has a place in the world to come. He's wonderful. But he's not the man to give over the system to. You see, the Torah does not believe that we are all equal. Even though that's something that we would all like to believe. Everybody wants to believe, well, we're all equal. Are we all equal? Do we all have the mind of an Einstein? Are we all as righteous as Abraham? Each person has to work with his own framework. That's a hard reality for people to take. You have to face your shortcomings. You have to know your abilities. You have to know your limitations, and you have to work within your own life. But but there are different people. Some people are capable of being an Abraham and Isaac. Ishmael was a very good boy, but he was an instinctual boy. What happened in the end? The Torah says that he stayed in the desert, and what did he become? He became a person who was very very capable and very proficient at shooting arrows. That's the that's 21:20. Okay, he was a good archer, excellent archer. Okay. Anything wrong with being an archer? The Torah says you're not allowed to be an archer. Is that a violation of the 7, of the 613? No, not at all. But that kind of a personality, while he may be a righteous person, you see, doesn't mean that he's equipped to carry, to inherit, to be heir to the system of the philosophy of Abraham. There you require somebody else. You require a different kind of personality. Okay? And I believe the Torah teaches us the same idea in Exodus, where when Moses was born, so it says, and his mother saw, it says, ki tov hu, that he was good. What does it mean he was good? What is the Torah telling you he was good? A newborn child, how could he be good? How could he be good? How could he be bad? But what the Torah is telling you is that he was endowed with unique qualities. He was different. He was different. See, the Torah does recognize the fact that there are people that are endowed with unique qualities, and there are people that aren't. There are people, everybody, of course, is unique in the eyes of the Torah. Let me make that point clear. The rabbis say just like their faces are different, their personalities are different. Every person is a unique individual. But that does not mean to say that every person can do every kind of job. That's not true. There are some people that are capable of being leaders in Torah. Some people are not capable. Doesn't mean the person not capable is not a righteous person. On his level, in his framework, he's fine. And that's the concept of Esau, because you see that Isaac loved Esau. How could he love Esau? After all, Esau was a man of the field. Isaac wasn't a fool. Then why did he love him so much? The answer is very simple. Because he thought that Esau was really, given his nature, he was a good person. He was not a bad person. He did not think he was a bad person. And Esau was very intent, of course, of always projecting that image to his father. Esau's whole life was revolved around one thing. What he wanted from life was the approbation, the respect, the love of his father. That's everything he did was for that. So it says, so that's why it says that he would bring whatever he would capture, whatever he would kill. So the rabbis say that here the Torah is using funny semantics. It means he captured him with his mouth. He captured Isaac with his mouth. He would fool him. He would ask him questions and ideas and make his father believe that he really is interested in following a Torah way of life. And his father was his son. His father believed him. But he knew he wasn't the one to carry on the system. You see, even though he wanted to give the blessings of the physical blessings to Esau, the blessings of Abraham, he always wanted to give to Jacob. And in the end of that scene, he calls Jacob in and he gives him the blessings of Abraham. He mentions it openly. So he knew his two sons, that the son Jacob was one that was going to carry on he's going to be heir to the whole philosophy. Esau won't be heir to the philosophy. But Esau doesn't mean he's a bad person. He's still a good person. With his emotions and with his makeup, he is a good person. Okay? And that's why he wanted to give him the physical blessings, because he felt he's the man of the physical. He needs this. As a matter of fact, he'll be able to take care of this better. He's not the great thinker. He'll take care of this in a better way, and then he'll help Jacob. He thought it was a great plan, both brothers together working in harmony. He didn't realize here was the woman that had the insight. Rebecca saw through that, and she knew that this is not going to take place. And she realized that by giving the physical, material blessings to Esau, Esau is just going to destroy Jacob. So she again had the foresight. But it's important to recognize in the Torah does not necessarily paint a person black or white. There are different levels of human beings. Not everybody. There are some people who are extremely emotional in nature, instinctual. Doesn't mean they're bad. They have to guide and control these instincts, these emotions. They're not the kind of person that could be an heir to a great system. They're never going to be an Abraham, an Isaac, a Jacob. They're never going to be a great Torah leader, a great Torah scholar. Doesn't mean they're bad people, you see. And that's the same thing with how the Torah looks at Ishmael. The beauty of the Torah is the Torah assesses every person according to their true worth. And you know very well that the Torah states in Deuteronomy that God gave to Esau the Mount Seir to inherit it. I mean, this alone is an amazing thing. Where do you ever see a religion that maintains and God helped them inherit it? So he helped them conquer it. So it was the hand of God that was active in helping Esau to conquer Mount Seir. Now, where do you ever see a religion that the God of their religion should help someone who is their enemy? I mean, this is not to be found. And Torah, it's right there, because Torah is the word of God, it's truth. And Esau was deservant at that point of Mount Seir, and that's what he inherited. What his offspring did later, that's a matter of free will. Every person has free will. Same thing with Ishmael. Ishmael, God, the angel told Hagar that you're going to be the mother of a great nation, and a great nation. And he is a great nation, was a great nation. Certain things they did were terrible, terrible things. But that doesn't mean they don't have potential. The potential is there. If they did not exercise their free will properly, then that's their fault. But the potential was there. The potential was given to them by God. And Hagar was the matriarch of that nation. There were very great, extremely great scholars that were the Arabian scholars. I mentioned that in the time of Maimonides and before that. And Maimonides had the greatest respect for many of them, because they were very high level people. And as a matter of fact, about Ibn Rushd, Averroes, Maimonides one time said about him that he said he was a man who really knew the truth. So you see that the greatness is not limited. Any human being can rise to extreme heights. I mean, if a Maimonides is praising an Averroes and says that he perceives a certain ultimate truth, I mean, this is an extremely high level individual that we're talking about. And again, it shows that the Torah is universal. Does not restrict anything, take anything from any human being. It allows each person to develop and to realize their own full potential. Okay. Any questions?
No, I think that's a good place to end on right there.
Okay.
You give us the emotional end and then the part of God, you know, the fairness and all. I think it's a good point.
Okay.
And you did well.
Okay,
and it's good to have you back in our midst. And so next week we will stand by and wait to be amazed at your words again.
Thank you.
All right. Hey, and I'll call you. I got some more information.